right? Now, in these talks, we've been telling a lot of stories. Sometimes we tell several stories, and sometimes we tell no stories. And we have several reasons for telling the stories. In one way, they work as a social lubricant. They put us in a state of mind that we are more at ease. The chief reason we tell the stories is because the stories are universal language. And in our diversity, being probably pretty highly individualized, it's important to have something that unifies us. And the reason that the stories are a universal language is because the life of them comes from universal realms. It comes from the world of ideas, and that is beyond our personal differences. We're much more in a common spirit. We need that life that comes from those transcendental realms to keep us from dying here. I tend to think that that life that we experience in stories is probably as much important to us as food is. And this is sort of a desert because we're separative here, we're too concrete, we're too materialistic, and we need life to keep our psychology going in a positive way. Without that life, we would probably die in spirit and we would become something less than. As time passes, though, we're going to be able to experience those worlds from which the stories come more and more directly. And the stories won't be so important then. Now, in a curious way, spiritual being and spiritual beings need these concrete worlds that we just alluded to as being so barren. Divinity has to create. It's essential to its nature to create. And it's not itself if it isn't creating. However, creation has to be realized. And the realization is done here. Now, this does not mean that this world is more real, and that things here are more real, as many people believe, because they definitely are not. It just means that spiritual creation is objectified, it's tested, and it's proven, and it's carried out and finalized as far as it can go. That's the realization process. Even though the reality is limited. Now, in the sphere of human activity, this means that stories become history, and for all evolving beings that we see around us, the stories become evolution. We're not talking about the three bears in the fairy tale, but we're saying that bears in themselves have their own stories that they are living out and that are living into a material reality. Cosmologically speaking, the next step in the store for humanity is a return to the ethers and to return one level closer to divinity, to be more in a realm of vital life and of energy, and not so stony in concretion. Now, since Aquarius rules the ethers abstractly, we've had this little subset of three talks on the ethers in order to prepare ourselves for taking the next next step. Even though these talks are somewhat far-fetched, there is an intent to be practical. And we've been trying to see how the ethers can be seen in our daily lives and how we can utilize them, if nothing else, but to gain awareness of them or to become to be able to manipulate them. Some of the things we've been saying have been almost silly, but I don't care whether they're silly or not, whether they get people to work with the etheric energy is what is important. In the first of this sub-series, we talked about a look at the ethers. We looked at the nature of them and of their function, and we tried to be experiential about that as much as possible. We spoke of means to progressively experience them and to directly use them. In the second talk, which was our most recent talk, we was called Ethers, Angels, and the Aquarian Age. We spoke of changes in attitude necessary to experience the ethers, the attitude that we had to have, and to understand the denizens that lived there. And we talked specifically about fairies and angels. We spoke about character adjustments. Now, in this final talk, we're going to carry all of this a little further. We're going to talk a little bit about experience, and we're going to talk about interactions of the kingdoms and adjustments in consciousness in the historification and evolution that we are participating in. Of course, there will be a little bit of recapitulation and review, and we're going to cover some things that we've covered before, but we're going to look at them a little bit differently so that we can become familiarized. Sort of like traveling to another country. It pays to know where we're going because the knowledge, provided that it doesn't bias us, will help us to be able to function well in that country. So the title for this talk is called Humanity, Ethers, and the Aquarian Age. Now, to work into these things about the ethers, I'd like to talk about two interlocking spiritual truths that have been immensely helpful to me in understanding reality. The first principle could be called the principle of universal identity and identification. In the Bible, this principle is stated by Christ Jesus when he says, "I and my Father are one." It could be stated, "I and the universe are one." Another way of stating it, one that we have used before, is to say that to know oneself is to know God. In the unity of the universe, there is a common identity. And when we discover our basic nature, since we are part of the universe, and in our most basic sense, we are part of that identity. So knowing ourselves in spirit is knowing God in spirit. Now the second principle is a principle of reciprocal internal dualism. A reciprocal internal dualism within what could be called the absolute. It involves a problem in creation itself. And it involves how creation can take place within that unity. How can division enter into the unity of the universal spirit? this principle could be called God playing make-believe for keeps. It is a process of projecting something unreal and realizing it. We saw this principle a little bit in the Aquarius Leo talk when we were talking about altruism. The principle has to do with giving oneself in creation to internal divisions. Now, when we work with things like this, we have to be aware that if we're not careful, they become tautologies. And when they are tautologies, they're effete. They don't give us anything new, anything vital that we can live by. In philosophy, these things are called circular logic. In folk language, it is characterized by saying this is like a dog chasing its tail. And that can be happen. That can happen if we're not careful. Let's be conscious of that possibility in the first principle, which is the principle of universal identity and identification. A famous Aquarian, Lewis Carroll, wrote a poem on this principle. It was called The Day of the Walrus. Being a mathematician, he was used to working with this principle extensively. For example, there's a whole study in trigonometry of looking at identities, where all of these different things are really all the same thing in another form. The Beatles taking off from Lewis Carroll and under the influence of Maharishi wrote a song on the poem and on this principle. And it contains a famous line that states the principle very well. I am you, and you are me, and here we are together. God and spiritual self are one. Therefore, one and the cosmos and everything in it are one. That's what the word universe means. It means one thing. We hear these faddish pseudo-ideas that are prevalent now in science and pseudoscience talking about parallel universes. And that is an oxymoron. It's self-contradictory. Universe means one thing. And if it's one thing, it's true that you may not have experience of other states of the universe. And they could be existing and we wouldn't know about them. But they are not parallel universes. They are still all part of the same universe. And if we can put our consciousness in to the most unified level of that universe, we could experience those other things. If one uses such a universal identification in any kind of a phrase, like saying God is love, that can both be profound or it can be trite and shallow. How much we can live it, how much we can put the spirit into it, or how much we can spirit it. So therefore, there's a big difference in when the same words are said by Christ when he says, I and the Father are one, than if Richard Kepsel says, I and the Father are one. I obviously cannot live that reality and sustain its being to the same degree that Christ could do it. The living of it requires soul power. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the ethers. We're talking about experience that literally feeds and awakens the spirit. Now, by itself, this principle is great for centering and for focusing, but it's not the end. It's more a beginning than it is an end. Okay, now let's try to understand the second principle, the principle of reciprocal internal dualism. Principle is also found in popular culture. The common unifier of disparate things is love. And with love, one understands diversity as part of unity at the same time. These are interlocking principles. I happen to be a lover of jazz, and there's a jazz standard, I believe, that was written by Jerome Kern. And it's called All of the Things That You Are. It's a great jump to it. And the song consists of an enumeration of various things that come to mind, somewhat sentimentally, to the individual singing or who has written the song. And the unification of all of these various diverse things that are emotionally meaningful, unification of it comes in the catch line, which is all of the things you are to me. So that when you understand someone and you love someone, all of these other things fit together and they're unified in one thing because of that love. Of course, Jerome Kern understood the experience in a different way than probably Christ Jesus would understand it also, but nonetheless, it's a very pretty song. So one finds difference and commonality in the unification at the same time. This principle is the basis of a deep creation myth that comes from early India. And in this myth, the one is lonely and bored, and so it makes believe that there is another. And in that making believe, in that other, one knows something of oneself and realizes oneself at the same time as realizing that which it imagined. One understands that the other must in some way be real, even though it is an imagination. Discovers the self. And then one is no longer lonely until that discovery is not enough. And you have to create something more and realize even more of your potential in creative dreams. We're in the process of that. And we do that. This means that our lives, as part of that, since we share the unity by the same principle, this means that our lives are totally purposeful. That everything that we do, if we could see it with that perspective, would be purposeful. Now, this is a very important principle that has been used in various ways by various different mystics. Favorites is to understand the without, look within. And to understand yourself, look without. Like there is a reciprocal unity between the within and the without that is all tied together. Again, seeing ourselves in the world, part of popular culture. So it's not always practical. Even little children on the playground know this principle. If somebody calls somebody else a name, what will that little child respond with or other children respond with? It takes one to know one. It's the old thing that goes back to childhood And that's the same principle. And the realization of the importance of this is in that famous line by Bobby Burns when he said, "Oh, would some God the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us." So if one wants to know oneself, one only needs to write about something. Take any topic outside of yourself and write about it. And when you write about it, you out yourself. You externalize yourself, and you come to know yourself. And when you read what you have written, now there's a lot of excitement in the discovery while you're writing. And when you read what you've written, you know yourself as somebody else knows you. It's really, keeping a journal or doing something like that is a really wonderful practice for self-realization. It's in ourselves that we make connections about the outer world. We know that this is causal to that, or that this is related to that, because we recognize the unity in ourselves. So this principle is a principle that bridges events and responses and the understanding of events and responses. Now, even misapplications of this principle are fruitful if one practices discernment and discrimination impartially. Now, suppose someone lies and says something untrue. Now, the objective reality of the external world is not going to bend to the lie. And the lie will wither away because it isn't true. It doesn't stand the tests of reality. One of the most common kinds of lies that we make in things like this, and mystical people have to be very careful about it, especially in social circumstances, this comes out. If a person is insecure and the friends are acting in a way that individual thinks is rather strange, the person is likely to read meaning into things. Not read meaning out of things, but read meanings into them. And if a person is objective and not so insecure, these things will prove to be not true. But even in the process of reading into things, one tells a lot about oneself, and one knows a lot about oneself. Luke can tell you that there are a lot of different psychological practices where you get a person to spontaneously talk about anything, a Rorschach test or a Minnesota multiphasic, where you get a person telling stories, and they tell themselves without even knowing that they're telling themselves. So this, on one level, if we do this, it tells us that we're pretentious, that we pretend to knowledge that we don't have. But it all comes out in the wash. We clarify about ourselves. Now, like cause and consequence, this is a pretty foolproof principle. It means that there are no complete and absolute lies. Even things that we say that are factually untrue is telling us a lot about the liar. And if we look for the reason why someone is lying, we can discover a great deal about that person. Now, this principle works very perfectly in the other direction also. For example, we may not believe something about the external world, or claims that people make about the external world. Suppose somebody says that this herb has a curative property for this kind of condition, and you don't believe it. But you try it, and certainly it has exactly the effect that one said it would have. It's it's sort of like we learn about the external world by our experience of it. It's a trivial example, but we've all gone through that example. It's the perfect example for showing us that if we want to know anything about the external world, like universal gravitation, the way Newton did, by looking inside of himself, he came to an answer. At one time when I was very young, I'd say it was about 1969 or 70, over in the woods over here, I had a tree that I would talk to every day. I would talk to it inside of myself, but the tree out there was a friend. And I assumed that the spirit of the tree, as it was inside of me, that responded to me like I respond to myself when I'm talking to myself, it was surprising how much knowledge it had. It was just flowed with wisdom about things. And it was using something external to produce an internal-external dialogue. Now let's try to look at these principles with very simple mathematics and with the astrology of Aquarius in a very unusual way of looking at Aquarius. Now, being relative to non-being automatically defines two states. You say it another way, non-being is symbolized in the concept of zero. Being, or a state of being, or anything that exists, or beingness, is indicated by the number one. One is the commonality of all things. This is one with a capital O, which the spiritual mathematicians like the Platonists didn't consider an integer like the other numbers. One was the one, because everything had that common being to it. Now, there's nothing to know in non-being, and but the concept of it, knowing that it is potentially there, is conceivable from limitation. So being describes both being and the potential of non-being, which are two states. You can't say that being and non-being are both one, even though they're only defined from within one. So where there is one, there is two. Two being a state or enumeration of one relative to not one. You want that kind of logic talk. Thus, there is two within one. And for that matter, all numbers are within one. All numbers are divisible by one. It's the common solvent of all numbers. Now, this is a problem that has a long history. It is called the problem of the one and the many. It began with the Platonists, or at least that's the first place we find it in history, in cultural history. And after the Greco-Roman civilizations dissolved into what in Europe were called the Dark Ages, it was taken over by Muslim philosophers, and they really took to it because the idea of the one and the many was very palatable to the rigid monotheism that Islam had. And so it was developed in many ways, probably at the end, Rabi. So one conceiving the one can realize one's oneness internally. So self, or I, conceives of itself and divinity at the same time, because that conception is the oneness itself. Conception and the reality are one. intuitively discovered by the same action. In English, we have a very fortunate homonym in that the name for self is I, and that has a homonym with EYE, the organ of perception. And so we describe self as the seer. We even have the image of a symbol of that on our money. It's the pyramid with the eye at the top, the all-seeing eye. The one, the eye, differentiated pyramidically, like as in a pyramid scheme, separating through all of reality. And from this, we have all kinds of different statements that, if thought about, make sense. For example, the biblical statement, I believe it's from the Apocalypse, where it is said the beast has many eyes. And it even goes so far as to say that there are eyes internally and it has eyes within and without. It's so obvious that it's strange that Orthodoxy doesn't pick it up. Now, from this, the jump to Aquarius is a small one, but it's a difficult kind of jump because it involves paradox, which is perfect because Aquarius is the sign of paradox. Now, one of the qualities assigned to Aquarius is the unique. There's a tendency to say that Aries is like a ram, or that Leo is like a lion, but Aquarius is like Aquarius, and each Aquarius is different, which is saying that Aquarius rules uniqueness. So this immediately thrusts us back on one being, as with a capital O, and one being with a small O, because what we're talking about here is that each one of us is a one, and each one of us is akin to the one. And so the principle of altruism, where one loves unique individuals, unites one to all of humanity and unites one to divinity by the same stroke. And so that is what we are looking at with Aquarius. Good evening. Aquarius is a human sign. It has human and it has humane qualities. It is an intellectual sign, an air sign. So humanity, each human is a rational being. We are thinking beings. It is a sign of altruism. And in pure altruism, as we just saw, there is unique individuality. In altruism, the other and the all are one. We are ourselves in the others if we are altruists. And our self-consciousness is found in the all. It's that other principle, or the second principle that we were talking about. In our personalities, where we are selfish and egoistic, we don't see things that way. And this is why we have the admonition from Christ, love thy neighbor as thyself. This is not do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is a very practical way of getting what you want. What we're talking about here is that the other is self. It is a way to open to enlightenment, and it is at the same time a way to be free from gross egoism. The neighbor, in specific, general, is a common denominator of where we find our selfhood. It's a greatest common denominator and not a least common denominator. I only know myself in you. This is based on that same universal principles. Our future is altruism. And eventually, we'll still have individuality, and that individuality will continue to be stronger, but it will be greatly superseded by altruistic consciousness. And in that altruistic consciousness, as it applies to humanity, it will apply to humanity in general. To the angels, humanity is one, and it is of one. This is what is really meant in the statement by Christ in the Bible: who has done this to the least of these has done this unto me. Because each human being is a focus of that altruism, and that altruism in life spirit is the universal creative love that is shared in common by all individual selves. All right, we've been looking at the principle of one and the principle of pure being. And we've noted that with waking consciousness of being, there is a sense of potential, of things that could be. Now, even though potential or non-being exist, at least in the eye of being, though it can't be seen, that's paradox for you, there is always more that could be. There is potential within oneself. There is an externalization of non-being as potential. We experience this quite frequently in our daily lives. When we learn something, we have the joy of learning something, but in that same act, we realize that there is so much more that we don't know. Even though we don't know what it is, we understand the potential that if we look further, or if we create further, we will know what it is. Thus, when we know one, we know two, and when we know two, we know many, or we know all. Two is the pluralizing number, and it brings all together. Now, of course, the knowing of the potential of two, of being and potential non-being, is internal. So let's look at for a little bit. Two is the number of a line. A good manifestation of two as a line is the shortest distance between two points. That is a pole. So the number two is the number of the pole and of polarization. Since we can't be in two places simultaneously, except if we are within the one, but then within the one, there is no knowledge in the same way. In the pole or polarization, there is a vacillation of consciousness. And in human beings, that's indecision. And in a human being, that is often extremism. So there is a vacillatory indecision between being and the scary non-being. This is taken at the deepest level. This is what is stated in the famous statement by Hamlet: to be or to not be. Which is worse, the boredom and the pain of all of the things that are around us, or the scariness of something that isn't, the non-being? Now let's look a little bit now at a mutual interaction between poles. You cannot strengthen or neutralize just one end of a pole. One extreme begets another. Classically, poles in two dimensions are usually oriented two different ways. One way or the other, or both. They are looked at either horizontally or vertically. Those are the common poles. They are accepted as the most basic differences in a plane surface. The horizontal, especially when we look at it on the astrological mandala, has to do with equals relationships, the differences between you and I, or between you and me, on a level playing field, we say. How are we different? The first house is self and rival, or adversaries, or spouses. So there's polarization in the horizontal orientation. Vertical orientation, which is seen between the midheaven and the nadir, is based on difference. And the difference is often a matter of superiority. In the astrological mandala, it's the difference between the subjective fourth house and the objective 10th house, or the seclusive 4th house and the worldly or societal 10th house, or the personal subjectivity of the 4th house versus the impersonal objectivity. In fact, the whole lower half of the mandala is microcosmic, whereas the upper half of the mandala is macrocosmic. Now we're looking at Aquarius and the Aquarian age, and we're trying to work our way into that age to the best of our ability. When we look at the symbol for Aquarius, we see a similar upper-lower kind of division. And that's what we want to focus on. It's a childish way to represent it compared to the other things we've been trying to talk about, but it's the upper wave can be seen as the transcendental, the universal that we've been speaking about. And the lower is the phenomenal, the material things as we've been seeing them. Now, if we make such an assignation to these two waves, the upper wave is for Uranus, and the lower wave is for Saturn. Uranus, as we seeing all along in these talks, is altruistic. It is for impersonal freedom, no favorites. The statement that no one is free unless all are free. Or the statement we are set free through the freedom of others. Saturn is more self-oriented. Doesn't mean it's bad, but it's more self-oriented, and it's more for individual liberty than for the collective. It likes exclusivity, the kind of exclusivity that separates one in such a way that one can be seen as unique. Now, to proceed forward, let's recall something from an earlier talk on freedom and creativity. Noted that there are three things that are necessary to be free, and they lead to three different degrees or stages of freedom. The first thing is knowledge. If we have knowledge, we are empowered. We can elect to make decisions. First stage of freedom is election, that we can choose, that we know the options. A person is not free if they see only one option. In my younger days, I used to carouse a bit, and I saw bar or fights and things like that, and almost without fail, the person who threw the first punch justified it by saying, I had to do it. I had no other option. He made me do it. Even though it was the volitional first action, that's somebody who does not have freedom. Obviously, they sold their freedom off to the alcohol. The second factor is a person must have self-control. And with self-control, we can follow out the choices that we have for ourselves. This is by self-application and self-control is how we develop our abilities. We say, with regard to nations, that a nation, in order to be sovereign, has to be in control of its own destiny. It can't be overpowered by another. The free individual, the free individual is an invulnerable individual. You can't hurt them. And the third degree of freedom, or the third quality of freedom, is creativity. And that is not only the choice not only the ability to see the options and make a choice, and to have the self-control or the wherewithal to carry it out, it represents creation, to make something new out of the opportunity. In fact, in some cases, in very deep degrees of freedom, one can actually even create the opportunities themselves. This goes beyond self-control, and it brings us to the kind of divinity that we've been speaking about all evening. We've been talking about creative qualities in spiritual being. One doesn't have to do things the way they were done before. One can find a new way, even though the situation is very much like all of the situations of this type that have preceded it. One can do something new and different. Now, for a few minutes, let's familiarize ourselves with these requisite abilities and stages of freedom, and let's try to simultaneously understand Aquarius by looking at the dual nature of the higher and lower waves. In that way, that brings us closer to our objective and how we see things and to understand things in the future. We'll do this by examining the polarity, the vertical polarity between the macrocosm and the microcosm. We'll be looking more at attitudes and not so much at things, and everything we look at will be considered good. So if we take knowledge, Saturn represents isolated individual experiences, data, facts. It's personal knowledge, and it is idiosyncratic. And it leads to a personal culture. We know and we have freedom because we know these specific things. People who have a trade can go anywhere in the world and they can find themselves something to do because they have that specific knowledge. Uranus, he is much more general knowledge. Often it's even eclectic, and it is knowledge of the human condition. It's cosmopolitan, it's international, it's universal knowledge. It's sort of like, I don't need specifics. He who reads may run. Because I understand the human condition, I can commune with someone even if I don't speak their language. If we look at the two waves with regard to self-control and the development of abilities or the performance of the individual or the talent or the self-security. Saturn represents a cool to cold impersonal control. On the other hand, it's humble and unpretentious because it isn't efficient to carry pretentiousness. Being individually oriented, it thinks in terms of self-rule. And with regard to the larger group, it's something like a democratic cell, the one vote caster. And it has individual dreams. And in its expression, it's a personal release. If we look at Uranus, it is one only has self-possession with regard to friends. It isn't a cool personal control. It is a control that one has because one loves one's friends and does what has to be done for their sake. There is a universal acceptance. And that universal acceptance brings an awareness of the all. And it thinks more in terms of utilitarian rule. What's good for the all? So with Uranian type of thinking, if it's pure Uranian, and we haven't subjugated the true Uranian nature into personal egoism, it's someone who's willing to sacrifice personal rights for the collective good. And so there is a social vision. I learned a long lesson. When I was married, we lived behind the Coliseum, up on the hill back in there. And we used to want to go out on Friday night to do things. And sure enough, we'd take off and we'd wanting to be going downtown, and there would be the massive traffic jam for the hockey game. And I was kvetching about it to a friend, and the friend said, "Well, Richard, that's what happens when you have to sacrifice individual rights for the collective good." And I was immediately put in my place. There was, remember Nancy Whitaker? Nancy Whitaker was the source of that. Remember her? She and Wayne, and they had three little children? Yes. If we look at the two waves in terms of creation, Saturn creates by seeing differences. It creates by contrast. And it is a self-reformation. Uranus creates by intuitive awareness. It has a spiritual, holistic vision of things. And it's revolutionary. It's willing to change everything, wipe everything out, not just the reforming. And it likes to create in sharing the dream. And everybody is free to create in the dream. Now, neither of these two ways is good or bad. They're just different ways. And they're two different approaches to freedom, and they're both necessary approaches to freedom. Now, we're trying to work our way back into the ethers, and this is a very roundabout kind of talk, and I'm sorry for that, but sometimes that's the way I work, is roundabout. And we're trying to tie these things together with things about the ethers that we have about in earlier talks. Now, in doing that, let's review another principle that we've looked at several times in the course of these talks. We have mentioned coevolution and mutual interaction between humanity and the cosmos. Now, by including the principles of universal identity and of reciprocal internal dualism, can carry these ideas all ahead a little bit. We can see them on various parallel levels of macrocosm, microcosm coevolution. In this, we remember that humanity has turned the corner in evolution, and we are becoming creators, and we are becoming less creatures. We are becoming cosmic contributors and not just dependent creatures. We even, in the early stages of humanity, before we had the kind of self-consciousness we had now, we were already used as creative vehicles. So let's look at this on three different levels, as individuals, as humanity, and as cosmic creators. As individuals, each of us is striving to spiritual self-consciousness. And we're doing that by trying to live creatively. Living creatively in our lives, not just in the studio, but by actually putting our creative consciousness in everything we do. As we are becoming self-aware, by that same stroke, we are aware of the other and of the unity of self with other. We can't be creative without doing that in us. And this automatically leads us, it's a natural course that leads us to unselfish acts for others, because it's like really harming ourselves, because our self is in the other, and when the other is harmed by a selfish act, we just can't do that anymore. This in turn, this giving attracts etheric stuff into the soul body, which relates us to the higher cosmos. Hence, creativity not only creates things, not only creates a creative life, it creates a new character. That's what we were talking about before with the Saturnine Reformation. If we look at it on the level of humanity, we can see that that altruism proliferates or expands our consciousness automatically to the awareness of humanity. We can read the consciousness of others. Sometimes there's not a discrete differentiation in the ethers. We feel that we really are the other. Now, when we do this collectively and when we have an understanding of the other, what this does is it reformulates society. It isn't an intellectual ideal or a designer cause or anything like that or political correctness. When we sense the whole of humanity through our individual development that has made us capable of that, things like racism or nationalism or religious separation or things like that can't take place, because you see right through them. It's that Aquarius transparency. You can see that you can't live that way. So we're creating simultaneously a new humanity. Cosmologically, or on the cosmic level, we create a new cosmic environment. We enrich the ethers of the cosmos. Now, there's a peculiar thing about this, that is that the relative to the lower ethers, which disintegrate after a while, the higher ethers are relatively, but certainly not absolutely, they approach immortality. And so we keep them with us in between lives. And this means that because more people are living more soulfully, there needs to be more of these ethers. And the consequence is that when we live altruistic lives and we live lives of selfless service, we actually necessitate and bring into being more of the ethers. We are changing the cosmos. Eventually, we'll even change what things that science now considers constant. This is what a cosmic consequence of altruism. truism is. Now, it must be remembered, in talking about these things, we're not talking about abstract ideals. We're talking about real things. The truth of this cannot be known to us. We cannot feel harmonious with it unless we live it. Unless, if I were to go out tomorrow and try to do something grossly selfish, it would close my consciousness and I would be a little less understanding. Now, these are real things. The individual soul body is not theoretical. If you find yourself outside of your physical body, you know instantaneously that it's not theoretical. Our freedom and our creativity are not theoretical. They're real. And they're real as long as we're living in them. And so the change of the scope of freedom is very dramatic. Our creative fluency is very fleet when we actually live in these things on the individual level. Our selfhood is real. And its character and its strength are determined at this time by the amount of soul food that we feed it. If we don't give the essence of soulful deeds, we don't become strong in ourselves. It's pitiable. The thing about neurotics is not that they just don't see the truth. It's just that they don't have the potency to live the truth out because, you know, they're all concerned about themselves. Humanity, looking in general, the character and nature of humanity, just like ourself, is fed, and it's a reality, and we can prove it to ourselves. If we can understand and work by things that are universal to all people and not necessarily to the idiosyncrasies of individuals, we know things that are human-wide. Our common experience is a reality, something that we know very clearly. We don't even have to speak the same language as someone else, and sometimes we can just look each other in the eye and we can understand each other's situation. And in that moment, it isn't just two people knowing each other. We know what we both belong to. This is the change in consciousness that comes on the human level. It might be said that we have world-class consciousness. And we have a common vision. I have yet to meet a human being that does not have the striving to do better in life. I have never yet met an individual that didn't have that. Now, if we look at this cosmologically, at the same time that we know ourselves individually and collectively in humanity, in that same knowledge, we come to know the character of the stuff itself. We come to know the nature of the ethers, the nature of life spirit wherein we are unified. We have a cosmic awareness and not just a human awareness or an individual awareness. And since the scheme of things is built right into the reality and states of being, we have an understanding of the way higher purpose is carried out. It's a very beautiful the way all of these things happen in parallel. Now, these things, as far as evolutionary schemes and things like that, are still potentials. But we understand that we must carry them out. We have, because in knowing the definite reality of the nature of the substance of the cosmos, we have that same definite view of ourselves. And it comes like a destiny that we know ourselves, that we are destined to do this because it can be no other way. All right, now let's review a little bit. no longer creatures. We are creators. And because we are cosmic beings, we are cosmic creators. By our work, by our service, by our heightened consciousness, we're changing the pitch and the constitution of the vibrations of the earth. Now, in the past, we spoke about, in those very early lectures, in the first three, we spoke about coming out of Atlantis, and in the Atlantean epoch, we learned to develop the brain and bring in the concrete mind, and we learned how to precipitate thoughts. And in that precipitation of thoughts, we used the Gemini principle of polarity. And in that polarity, we developed in our physical bodies, we were unconscious creators, but we were creators nonetheless, but in precipitation of concrete thoughts, we developed in our bodies lungs. And at the same time that we learned to precipitate thoughts, the consequence of this was a precipitation of the atmosphere of the earth, so that the rains came down and the earth was no longer shrouded in vapor. Now, what we're saying is that in a similar way, we are changing the next state of the earth. We are learning to bring this about through suffering and through imitation, creative imitation. Now, in all of this, I'm going to bring in something unusual now. it's the only way I could think of to unite this. I want to bring in illness, since we're talking about suffering. The suffering breaks us down from our selfishness, and it has a very pro-evolutionary effect. And I would like to just examine suffering on these three levels that we're looking at: the individual, the human in general, and the cosmic level. Now, many things in the spiritual life are counter to the way they seem. In modern creative evolutionary schools, ill health is not seen as a bad thing. This does not mean that we should be masochistic and intentionally do things to bring about illness, or that we should cling to illness when we have it, but we should see it as a reward and as an opportunity for spiritual growth that should not be wasted. This is a very unusual view about illness, but in modern terms, it is foolish to think that illness is unspiritual, whereas everything else in the world is spiritual. On the human level, illness is a way that we liquidate frozen destiny. And from that destiny, we extract the soul power and we process it. Laying in the hospital bed saying, why is this happening to me? If we listen for an answer, we can process right in the moment. But not all illness is personal destiny. Sometimes illness is a matter of evolutionary adjustment. This is similar to pain. Not all pain is a sign of danger. Sometimes it's actually even a sign of success. If we're trying to build muscles and the next morning we have pain in the muscles, that's not a sign of failure, that's a sign of success. Now, as the body, the dense physical body, is adjusting to the higher vibrating vital body, and more of our consciousness is otherworldly, the physical body has to make some adjustments. And those adjustments are evolutionary illnesses. They are are especially important in places where we are developing sense centers in our etheric and higher bodies. As one gets closer to leaving the body, it is helpful to not be too comfortable in the body. You know, in comfort, we become complacent, we become content, and we don't continue to move forward. So being a little uncomfortable as we are in illness is sort of a spur that goads us on. If we look at ill health in humanity, it is a constant, indubitable reminder of our deviation from the divine plan. It's a reminder to us that we are acting out of harmony with the cosmos and the principles behind the cosmos. Our rebellion to do our own thing without an eye to everything else in creation has brought us a kind of freedom, but in our deviation, we are not harmonious to the cosmos. So in common suffering, as in pandemia or something like that, it promotes a common sympathy. It promotes a compassion. We know we're not alone, and we know the urgency for the sake of others to reharmonize our path. We have to make a similar adjustment with regard to the earth, because we have to dissolve the earth. That's part of our work, and that can only be done collectively. So when there is a discomfort with the earth, it's a positive thing. Now, looking at this on the cosmic level is very difficult for me, because it's perhaps a little beyond my capacity. One thing is that it becomes obvious that we are deviant from the cosmological path, and it means that we have to find creative ways to find what we to find our way back to what was intended for us to be, not by some external credo, but from what was intended for us to be, from what is within us. And this is a very great creativity to change the cosmos in such a way that it is harmonious to all of the other beings in the cosmos, and at the same time is conducive to our realignment to the rest of the cosmos. And that's a major kind of creativity. And we're on our own in that. Because, you know, when we did what we did, no other being can really help us other than the beings that have, you know, we're the only beings in our solar creation that have ever worked against things. And all of the other beings, that's a completely foreign thing to them. And so on the cosmic level, it means we have to have a kind of consciousness of the intentions of the cosmos and a creativity that we can fulfill them. All right. Now let's try to synthesize all of this with what we've done in recent talks so that the whole is more coherent. It must be obvious by now that polarized study is a much larger statement of something we said about three talks ago when we said conceive universally, act personally, taking off from that idea of think globally, act locally. Cosmographically speaking, the vital body and the ethers are a reflection of the life spirit, which is the source of altruism. There is a harmony and a special direct connection between life spirit and the light ether in the soul body, such that direct wisdom can pass from the realm of pure truth into our etheric bodies to promote action in form of intuition. And in doing this, it bypasses the mind and the desire nature in such a way that we are not subject to them. In the level of life spirit, this means that the divine intent can be fulfilled without the chain of command that brings it through the inner adversary. The inner adversary must be dealt with, but as a stopgap measure in the difficult predicament that we're in, when we're sometimes we just like to do bad things and stupid things like that, this is a very important asset. This is another one of the features of more soulful living. The more soulful we live, the more stuff we have for intuition to play upon. And that's important. At the level of life spirit, unity is so prevalent that we all share the same common life spirit. There's not your life spirit and my life spirit. Not sharing is not even a possibility. And so as we develop the soul body, we develop with it, because of this unity of life spirit from which the soul material issues, we develop an attitude of acceptance. It is from life spirit that the ethers come about in the first place. Thus, there is a cosmological process taking place on two levels in the cosmos. On one level, the level that we've been speaking about all evening, we're building new ethers into our individual vital body and into the next globe of evolutionary activity. Individually and collectively, as we focus the consciousness of life spirit, which is the consciousness of focus, into our lives, the effect of this is to dissolve the physical earth and to float it or to suspend it into another dimension, into the etheric dimension. And we as human beings collectively, by a common and unbroken focus on life spirit, guide our globe through the next stage of evolution. It's when we do that, it won't be like driving a car. It's done in a different way. But at any rate, what will happen is we'll be working through our soul body, and the earth will become transparent, and the new earth will shimmer in a star-like fashion. It is this purposeful wisdom that to which we are trying to awake. And to some extent, that wisdom, though it is in us right now, is unconscious. So for just a very few minutes, I know this is really long, for just a very few minutes, I'd like to talk about unconscious wisdom and clarify a few potentially dangerous mistakes. Much of what we call natural law is actually the consciousness of divine beings that is so constant and so consistent and so perfect that it appears to us like laws, but it really is the consciousness of those beings. The way much of this consciousness functions is different than the way we as humans function now with our brain, mind, consciousness, and our great limitation. As was just said, when we're working with this kind of consciousness, it's not like driving an automobile, that we point it somewhere and it goes there. It's more like a homing and like a concentration, that we concentrate on something, in this case, a universal center of life spirit that is everywhere in no place at the same time, that what happens is intelligence and energy and wisdom flows out from it. it's set in motion by that very action of centering and concentrating. As long as the attention is held, the field that is produced is maintained, and there is wisdom in it. Now, this is a rather poor description, but it's a hard thing to describe, especially for me, because I'm only just beginning in the internal exercises to have the conscious experience of it. Now, it's dangerous to try and take the brain kind of consciousness into the unconscious part of wisdom and try to expand our consciousness in that way. We see examples of that. Sometimes we take in animals from the wild, little baby animals, and we try to raise them. And we don't have that same unconscious wisdom of the collective group spirit that guides those animals with their parents. And the best we can give them is what we have from our knowledge, and with science that is not a whole lot. And as a consequence, those animals are abandoned. They can't go back to nature again, and they can't be part of that unconscious wisdom. Another example, I had a friend who used to practice various different kinds of exercises to awaken more universal consciousness, and he wanted to put himself into what is now unconscious wisdom. He wanted to put himself there consciously. And with great and concentrated effort, he took control of the unconscious control of the breathing exercise or the breathing mechanism. What happened was that when he stopped having control of the breathing mechanism, he stopped breathing, and he panicked, and he had to constantly put his attention into this until eventually he, from exhaustion, just fell asleep, and natural process took over again. So these are examples of things that can happen if you try to enter into the unconscious in the wrong way. So when we are learning to guide the earth, or when we are learning to take over unconscious functions and make them conscious functions, it's not like learning to dance by footprints that are on the floor. It's more like feeling the music and moving to the music, and as it becomes second nature to us, then we realize how we can put our waking consciousness into it and creatively improvise or do things with it. It's sort of like having a big, beaming, positive smile and just never quitting. That's the way the consciousness feels like. So this is what is called the divine way. It is the divine way of the individual. Is the divine way of humanity, and it is the divine way of the cosmos. There is structure in it. It isn't completely free form, but in the divine way, we can interpret however we will, and as we grow in our creativity, we can improvise. We can improvise in living. In what we are in, this divine way, there is a kind of logic. It is a cosmologic. And if we get in the stream of that cosmologic, we can anticipate what is coming. It's very similar to listening to music, and when there's a chord change and the mood of the music resolves from one way to another way, we can anticipate that because we can feel the consciousness of the creator who made the composition. And in a way, this is a story that tells itself. It's something that has us perpetually amazed at what's going on. And what we are in we're really trying to live this kind of a life, this it is an exciting thing. It's a perpetual quest for freedom. Now, after all of that, would be foolish to try to say anything more on the subject, but there are a couple of addenda from the talk previous to this. And I wanted to work into it. I'll give you another example of the application of etheric energy. Now, etheric energy can be focused, and it can be focused in several ways. It can be focused by our consciousness. It can be focused by our consciousness in magnetic manipulation. Magnetic isn't the perfect word, but it'll have to do. But it's actually possible to focus etheric energy mechanically. And if you do that, you don't need any elaborate or sophisticated technology. There is a lens for etheric energy, and that lens is a shape. I believe it is NASA that holds the patent. I read that somewhere, and it seemed to be a reliable source. But there is a shape that has a patent. And the patent for that shape is for the perfect microwave antenna. And that shape is the same shape as the Great Pyramid of Giza. Now, there are plenty of books on the pyramid and pyramid energy and what you can do with them and experiments that are convincing and all. And if you want to work with etheric energy and even use it to help with healing and things like that, that's a good thing. I would only issue one caution, and that's not to use it too much. It's great if somebody is feeble or ill or old or something like that. The using pyramid energy can be very helpful to them. But if one spends too much time in it, one becomes psychologically passive and psychonegative, and one becomes mediumistic. So there's a danger. Now, the shape as a lens is not limited to the pyramid. Similarly dimensioned cones will have the same effect. The Native Americans knew this, and they used to say that when they were in their teepees, they were in the center of the earth, because they knew they had that experience and they knew there was a kind of energy to it. This has been used in Western society for a few centuries, but the shape was not optimal. But the dunce cap is an example of an etheric lens. And the other thing that this is a lead into the other thing from the last talk. And in the last talk, we talked about angels and about leaving the body. I was not clear about a description of the appearances of an angel. And that was for good reason, because it is too suggestive. But I will do a little of that at this time. Angels, compared to humans, are very large. Generally, their shape is conical. And the base of the cone is anywhere from 10 meters to as much as 80 kilometers, which is a long amount. And in that cone, there is streaming energy from the apex downward. And the angels actually are the life and intelligence of the plants that are within that sphere. In the center of it, there are spirals of concentrated energy that cross each other. And where they cross each other, there are brilliant centers or wheels of light. As seen by humans, they have human-like faces. The ascending and descending energy in concentration is a matter of their consciousness. Now, last time we talked about people who had enough soul material that when they learned to dissociate their attention from the physical body and had separated the soul body, they could put their attention in the soul body and leave the physical body behind. Usually they are initiates. Between those people who can do that and ordinary people, there is another state. And that other state is called invisible helpership. That means that there are people who have sufficient soul material in their etheric bodies that while their bodies are sleeping at night, they can be used to help other people. They work collectively in groups. They do things like teaching, like consoling people, healing, and things of that nature. Plus, there are schools of education for people who sacrifice to do that type of work. The invisible helpers are usually always led by initiates or the people who have that waking consciousness. Now, frequently, people see invisible helpers. And often they are mistaken for angels because most people don't know about invisible helpers, and they think anybody who can be so marvelously beautiful in such light must be an angel. They are, in a way, divine beings, as we all are divine beings, but they're not angels. If you can communicate with the being, it's most likely not an angel, because the consciousness of an angel is of a different order than ours. And so, because people have mentioned to me about having seen what they thought were angels, I certainly don't want to put the kibosh on it. It's a remarkable thing to have the ability to see that. I know of cases where people have had that happen once and their whole life was transformed forever and ever. All right, so this ends our sub-series of talks on the ethers in relation to Aquarius in the Aquarian Age. Now we have four more talks which are basically synthetic, or at least three of them are, and that will wind it up. The way it's going to work is after I finish the other Thursday class, the alternating Thursday class, we will meet every Thursday so we can get all of these in, maybe even without having to go into June. And again, to recapitulate, in this talk, we have been talking simultaneously on several levels about the way that leads us into the Aquarian Age and the way that leads us into the next stage of evolution. And when Christ Jesus is speaking from life spirit into the, or through the body of Jesus, which is very meaningful. I am the way, the life, and the truth. So what we have been trying to talk about this evening is the way. Thank you very much. Yeah.
You're so long.